Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper, and I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland. I'm your hostess for this evening. And as always, we are brought to you through the good offices of a great group of people who truly believe that all of us are this nation. That's Patriot Families, ladies and gentlemen, www.patriotfamilies.com. Come and visit our website. Get to know us as the family we are. You're more than welcome, and we'd love to welcome you to our family. Tonight's topic, ladies and gentlemen, on Patriot Education is the perils of standardized testing. I'm sure most of you by now have heard of Common Core and its requirements for a standardized method of teaching all core subjects across the nation in all grade levels through high school. This initiative by our federal government purports to give every child in the nation not only an equal opportunity to an education, but an exactly the same education no matter where he or she lives. In order to do this, one of the key elements of Common Core is standardized testing, making sure that all students are tested on what the government feels they should know at any specific grade level. Standardized testing has been around for a long time, ladies and gentlemen. I remember back when my pet saber-tooth tiger and I used to go to school together, we used a test called the Iowa Test of Basic Skills. ITBS was its acronym. And it did what Common Core standardized testing claims that it will do. The Iowa Test of Basic Skills was created by educators to measure the mastery of specific skills for the grade levels that were being tested. It was given not necessarily every year, but every 2 to 5 years, depending on the individual school and how they were set up. And it was a measure of the student's progress to determine whether or not he or she was ready to go on to the next grade level. If they had mastered the basic skills in math, for example, of a third grader, which included learning what multiplication was, memorizing one's times tables, understanding how to add and subtract using borrowing and carrying, or as they called it in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, renaming, understanding how to do a word problem, knowing when to add, subtract, multiply, or simple division. If you knew that 6 times 7 was 42, you were supposed to know that 42 divided by 7 was equal to 6, and 42 divided by 6 was equal to 7. These tests and their scores showed not only the students' scores based on mastery level, but they also had a comparative score, a percentile score, to show where the student fell compared to national averages. They were used to determine whether or not those basic skills had been mastered so the student would not be starting out behind when they began their next grade. It was a very useful set of tests, ladies and gentlemen, because not only did it give the students and their parents a clear picture of where their child placed on mastery of these skills, not only individually, but nationally, percentile ranking, it gave the teachers a clear picture of whether or not the students had gained from them what they needed to know. These tests were not tied to any form of funding, state or federal. They were purely academic in nature, and their purpose was to measure the child's progress. They were not used to determine whether or not a school would be accredited by the federal accrediting agency, or whether or not the school would qualify for additional federal funds, or whether or not the student was eligible for an individualized education plan, or any of the things that we supposedly are supposed to do with standardized testing today. Part of the reason that I chose this topic for this evening is that the school where I work is undergoing the dreaded Standards of Learning test. This happens every May for every grade. And in my state, the state standards of learning are used to a great extent almost identically to the old Iowa test of basic skills. But our standards of learning tests in my state are also used to measure the effectiveness of our school system. In each and every county, city, town, incorporated district, whatever, if the standards of learning test scores do not show that a majority of children are at or above grade level in their mastery of skills, the school's accreditation becomes in doubt. If the accreditation is denied based on this measurement of the school's success in teaching basic skills, federal funding is denied. If federal funding is denied, school staff and school programs must be cut. Funding is the backbone of the additional staff and programs needed to meet federal guidelines for the free, appropriate public education given to students who qualify under the Americans with Disabilities Act as it pertains to education. In other words, the federal government says that your school in your district must teach all children well enough that they can pass an individual grade level and be ready to go on to the next. Otherwise, you will not receive the funds you need to hire the people to make it possible for students with disabilities to achieve this goal. If that sounds like an oxymoron, ladies and gentlemen, you're right, it is. In other words, if your school doesn't do the impossible, you don't get any more money to keep trying to do the impossible. Standardized testing, instead of a measure of a student's ability or mastery, has become a very large stick with which to beat your school system. Wielded by the Federal Department of Education and its complete control over whether or not your school and your state get federal funds that will aid them in meeting the standards the federal government says they're supposed to meet in order to qualify and be accredited and get the funding they need to meet those standards. If this sounds like an oxymoron, given the fact that federal funding is being poured into programs to assist those students who cannot cope with a standardized classroom or standardized teaching methods and skill mastery, and when it can't do that, when the school system can't do those things, instead of looking at the way it's funded and what they might need, the funding is cut off and they're left to try to figure out how to get their standard scores up high enough so they get it back. There was a chart that I looked at that was published or posted to Facebook, but I believe it was the Heritage Foundation the other day. I think it was yesterday they posted, that showed the increase in staffing in public schools. And as staffing has increased, more and more money poured into more and more people to supposedly improve our educational system and its effectiveness with students. Guess what? Graduation rates have actually dropped among certain demographics. Skill mastery has dropped. Scores on standardized testing have dropped. So again, ladies and gentlemen, our beloved federal government has been pouring money, your money, down the proverbial rat hole. And believe me, I am not calling our children rats. They aren't. But they are children. My friend Linda says they want to pour more money into the Veterans Administration system, too, and that's apparently not working terribly well. This is scandal number, 17 in our second term of the current administration? We are facing a crisis in our educational system, ladies and gentlemen. It has been coming upon us for the last 20 years. Actually, it began with the creation of the Federal Department of Education under the administration of Jimmy Carter. Creating a federal agency to monitor and use the carrot and stick approach of federal money to force states to educate children the way the federal government thinks they should be educated has given us a generation of who barely know that George Washington was the first president of the United States and can't subtract 17 minus 9 without a calculator. And I am not kidding about that second part, ladies and gentlemen. I have seen my students pull out a calculator to subtract 5 minus 3. I am not kidding you. This is what government has done to our schools, which used to be among the best in the world. Now they are a laughingstock. They literally are a laughingstock. Because the richest nation on earth, with the most freedom and the most opportunity, is, I hate to say accidentally because I think it is deliberate, creating generations of citizens who haven't the knowledge or the ability to acquire knowledge to determine anything for themselves. We are allowing our children to be taught into dependency and permanent victimhood We are spending billions of dollars, ladies and gentlemen, to, according to the federal government, make sure that everyone has a free, appropriate public education. The kicker there is the word appropriate. When you and I say that something is appropriate, generally we mean that it is socially acceptable or that it is the right solution to a problem or that it is the correct manner of doing something because it is successful. But that's not what appropriate means in the federal education system. A free, appropriate public education system does not mean that it is an appropriate education for mastery of skills and the ability to continue learning once you have left school. Oh, no, 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 no. That doesn't what it means. Isn't what it means. It means it must be appropriate for the specific student's weaknesses in order to make that student feel good about himself that he has passed through 12 years of school and can barely write his name. I am not in any way, shape, or form against the Americans with Disabilities Act. I believe it was a very necessary piece of legislation that gave access to public life and public facilities to those who were physically handicapped and could not enter into public life as full citizens. It was, as most legislation, to try to promote equality under the law, well-intentioned. But unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, we know which road is paved with those. And our government has been taking us down that road for 30-plus years now. Good intentions have caused more harm in this world than practically anything I can think of, including malevolent, pure evil. Because good intentions don't stop. They continue to carry the fix to absurd lengths. For example, when students with learning disabilities were granted status under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the intent was to provide reasonable accommodations, which is in the exact language of that particular law as it applied to those who were physically handicapped. Reasonable accommodations, meaning that if you were a paraplegic, a ramp so that you and your wheelchair could get into a courthouse to serve jury duty or to file your will or go to the DMV and get an ID card or get into hospitals and other public facilities were things like that people needed to have. They were reasonable. They made sense. Yes, we want people to be able to use an elevator. So lowering the buttons so that they could reach it from a wheelchair was an excellent idea. Even putting Braille on the button was an excellent idea because blind people have to go places too. But reasonable stopped being reasonable quite a while ago. A reasonable accommodation in education means anything that parents can force the school to do under threat of a lawsuit under the 501 claim. A 501, ladies and gentlemen, is the federal form that entitles your child to that free, appropriate public education as required by the ADA as it pertains to education. It's alphabet soup, I swear. We've gone back to the Roosevelt era. So we have students who have their standards of learning tests read out loud to them. The reading test is read out loud to them. And if they pass it, and their score is shown as their reading ability. We have students who expect to have everything in the classroom that is printed on paper read to them by someone because they have not learned how to read. Because reasonable accommodation has been stretched to encompass just about everything, I have personal experience with a student who took 7.5 hours to complete a 3-hour reading test. No, nobody read it out loud to him. It just took him that long to get all the way through it and answer the questions. Because nobody should be timed on these tests. He scored quite well, which indicated that he was obviously ready to go to the next grade level. The fact that he could not read a paragraph in the time it took for the rest of the class to read it, 10 minutes for the rest of the class, 45 for him, meant that he could not keep up with anything in his classes, literally. If he had to read anything in class, everybody either had to stop and wait until he got finished with it, or he had to skip over it and just try to pay attention to the teacher and follow what they were saying and hope somebody would read it to him when he got home. This is a quote-unquote reasonable accommodation, according to the federal government, ladies and gentlemen. The difficulties that our kids are facing in the real world stem not just from the social and familial changes we have seen over the past 35 to 40 years, but our public schools are responsible as well. They are not the only entity responsible for the dumbing down of the national mind, but they are a part of that dumbing down. There are other factors. Changes in the medical and technological fields that allow people to live longer and remain healthy and active for longer periods of time have increased the number of people who are, like me, seniors, and our desperate fear promoted by environmental and population control talking heads has encouraged Americans to limit their families, which means that we baby boomers outnumber young people. And that means that we are targeted by advertising way more often now. If you paid any attention, if you're watching television on a regular basis, I wonder if you have noticed the predominance of advertising aimed at seniors. It used to be that most advertising on television was aimed at the 25 to 35 group because they were the main consumers. They were the ones who were going to be buying the things that were being sold. But that group are probably still living at home because they can't find a job. And one of the reasons they can't is because they haven't been educated to understand that having a job means you actually have to work. And they have not been educated to understand that having a job means you're probably going to have to continue learning things. And they have been allowed to believe that I don't have to know that, it's not on the test, is a viable reason for not studying something. And all of those things come back to standardized, watered down, feel-good educational policies that have been insinuated into our public schools on the backs of large amounts of cash. There's an old saying that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And there's another one. The love of money is the root of all evil. You put those two things together and you have an excellent description of our federal government today. When you believe that you have the right and the duty to decide for other people how they will live, then you are falling into the trap of the first of those things. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. My friend Bohr from the chat room says there's a third saying that's relevant here. It's a rare man that can resist the highest bidder, and that is also true. I remember a story told about Churchill, and I don't know whether it was actually he, but it's been ascribed to several different political leaders over time, of a dinner party where the gentleman in question, Churchill or one of the leaders of British government, was seated next to a very attractive lady and was in effect flirting with her, and her response was, "What do you think I am, a prostitute?" And the politician's response was, "Madam, we have already determined what you are. Now we're merely discovering your price." In effect, that is exactly where we are now. The lure and the love of money has been the root of all evil in our schools. You can trace the dumbing down back to the mistaken idea that when we desegregated our schools nationally, we needed to compensate Black American children who had been going to quote-unquote inferior schools by lowering standards so that they would not feel overwhelmed by the higher level of education in the wealthy white suburban school districts into which they were being integrated. The sad part of this is that the children who are being integrated into these wealthier, better schools were probably better educated than the white kids in whose classes they were placed. Not because they had fancier buildings or brand new textbooks or better teachers, but because they knew what it was like to have to work hard to get an education, because they had parents who saw that the only way that real equality would arise was through equal opportunity. They did not ask to be compensated. They did not ask to be told, "We'll make you smarter because we already know you're dumb." They asked only for the chance. None of the Tuskegee Airmen expected to be given their rank because of their race. All they wanted was the chance to show that they could achieve their rank and take on the dangerous and responsible job that was so sorely needed in a terrible war. Basically, we are doing the same thing, ladies and gentlemen, in our schools to all of our children that we did to those Black American children integrated into supposedly superior white suburban schools. We are telling our kids that If you don't succeed, it's somebody else's fault. And you need to blame them and demand from them the trappings of success, whatever those are, because it's their fault you didn't study, do your homework, or pay attention in class. I had a student yesterday in my mini jail who had spent the last 6 weeks doing no homework and not paying a bit of attention and getting really bad grades on everything. And this student asked me if the standards of learning test scores would compensate for a falling grade point average over the last quarter if the previous quarter's grades had been good. And I told the student, I cannot give you an answer because in our school system, there are many factors that determine whether or not a student goes on to the next grade level. Standardized standards of learning tests do play a part. They still are used to determine whether or not a student has mastered the skills he or she needs for the next grade level's work. And they are also used to determine whether or not a student's mastery matches their grade point average, which can indicate that the student is either placed in the wrong classes or there may be other factors that are affecting that student's GPA. One of my teacher friends was doing a survey on Facebook as a part of a course she is taking, and she asked for a response to, should standards of learning test scores determine whether or not a student passes, regardless of their grade point average? The overwhelming response was no. And 90% of those responding basically said for the same reason it should be no. Because if students are taught that they do not have to put forth effort to succeed, then what becomes of our society? When we tell our children that they do not have to try or work at something that is difficult for them, then we are telling them that they are incapable, weak, dependent victims, and somebody else should take care of them. My friend Vorp says, a no-effort society, and it sounds like communism. You're exactly correct. That's exactly what it is. It is the usual liberal progressive confusion about what equal means. Al Sharpton's equal stuff in everybody's house is pretty close. We can have that, sure. If we all live in a tar paper shack with no running water, we will all be equal as far as what we have in our house. We're not all going to be able to live in the latest McMansion with 15 televisions, servants, and 5 cars. But our educational system is trying to tell our kids that if they don't work, don't worry, it's not their fault. They'll get a good grade, they'll pass, they'll get a high school diploma, and then we're done with them, and we don't tell them what's going to happen after that. My friend Linda says you can have a no-effort society if you run for office. Well, it kind of takes effort, Linda. It's for some people, it's difficult to tell constant lies. Others are very good at it. We have several examples before us on the news just about every day whenever we hear from our elected leaders. For some people, lying is difficult. For others, it seems to be a very natural and frequent thing. The students that I deal with ladies and gentlemen, are middle schoolers. Their ages range between 12 and 14. They are just beginning to enter the adult world. They see their world always going to be exactly as it is right now. None of them has lived long enough to gain the life experience that someone of even 25 or 30 has. By the time you have achieved the age of 25 to 30, you have learned something about the real world in that you're not generally rewarded for doing nothing. Even if you are a so-called welfare queen whose main means of support is to become as pregnant as possible, as often as possible, with as many different men as possible, you still have to put at least a little bit of effort into it. And the stress and strain and so on and so forth of all of the other bad habits you have eventually shortens your life. And I'm not necessarily trying to be doom and gloom here, but that's pretty much the way it goes. But even that kind of life requires some physical effort, if nothing else. But our kids are being told that effort is unnecessary. If it's hard, I shouldn't have to do it. It's the community organizer mentality, ladies and gentlemen. Pay me lots of money and I'll stand up and make a really good speech and get everybody really, really angry and we'll all go march on something. I lived through the 1960s, ladies and gentlemen. I was born in 1946. I was in college from 1965 to 1969. High school, 1961 to 1965. I remember the quick, let's protest something mentality. The world stinks. And young people fell into two categories. Either you tuned in and dropped out and went to San Francisco for the free love drug culture, or you went out and grabbed a sign and started protesting something, usually the Vietnam War or, you know, anything that vilified the military-industrial complex. And you wouldn't dare be caught dead expressing conservative thought because that meant that you had a middle-aged mind, and, of course, this made you totally a social leper. Well, I was a social leper because I did have, quote-unquote, a middle-aged mind. I have been a conservative since I was 14 because I have a brain and I use it. Yeah, and that's where it comes down to. And because not only was I taught to use my brain by my family at home, I was taught to use my brain by my teachers in school. Nobody ever told me, it's not your fault you failed that test. What they told me was, you need to study more. When I was in high school, freshman in high school, as a matter of fact, class, because my standardized test scores showed that I was reading basically on a college level. And through a clerical error, I was also placed in an advanced Algebra 1 class. I had absolutely no clue what they were talking about in there because I had had basic math all the way through 8th grade. In those days, 8th grade math did not include anything that related to pre-algebra. The closest we came to an equation was a formula for determining interest. Interest equals principal times rate times time. Or the understanding of how to convert fractions to decimals to percentages. I was lost. Everybody in there knew what they were doing because most of the kids in that class had taken either pre-algebra or the first half of Algebra 1 in 8th grade. I felt so stupid. I just couldn't figure out what they were talking about because they basically started the course about 5 chapters into the math book. And I thought I must have been the dumbest human being in the entire universe. I brought home my first report card, and I thought my poor father was going to have a stroke when he saw I had a D in algebra. Everything else was an A. It's the first time in my life that I ever got a grade below a B. And I'm sure he thought that I was doing nothing, and he told me so. He said, what are you doing in there? You're not listening. Did you not do your homework? Do you not study? And, of course, I broke down in tears and explained, yes, I've been studying my delicate Guerriero, but I don't know what they're talking about. So he went to the school to try to find out what was going on. And that's when he discovered the error in the class placement. But in those days, you didn't get to shift out of a class once the first report card had been given. You had to stay in that class for the rest of the year. So I spent a heck of a lot of time trying to teach myself algebra and keep up with people who already were at least 6 months ahead of me when I got there. I finished the course with a C. I was not particularly thrilled, but I was so glad that I had gotten something other than a D that the C looked pretty doggone good. I really didn't learn algebra until I was in my 20s and was teaching it to other people and had access to an algebra book, Pre-Algebra and Algebra 1. I taught myself the pieces that I had not gotten. Nobody told me it wasn't my fault. Nobody told me that we could sue the school for putting me in the wrong class. Nobody told me I could take an easier course. They just told me I'd have to work my butt off and catch up. My friend Vorp says that they're no longer teaching cursive handwriting, and that is quite correct. They don't. They introduce it briefly in third grade, and then they ignore it for the rest of the student's academic career. Cursive is too hard. 90% of the kids that I see when I substitute teach or have them in my jail cannot read my cursive handwriting. And my handwriting is excellent. They simply can't read cursive because they can't write cursive. It requires too much effort. It's too hard. Too many teachers complained that it was difficult to read the handwriting of third and fourth grade boys. No kidding. It's almost impossible. Purely and simply because small motor coordination develops earlier in childhood for girls than it does for boys. My friend Bill brought up a good point just now in the chat room, too. Won't that create more identity fraud? You can bet it will. You can bet it will. When all you can write is manuscript, printing, that leaves you open to just about anybody making a very good copy of your quote-unquote handwriting. My friend Borb says that I can write cursive, doesn't mean I can read it. Well, I learned how. And it was kind of funny. When my husband and I first got together, my husband was dyslexic, which I've mentioned on this show before. And his handwriting was god-awful. Believe me, it was. From the first time he ever tried to learn it all the way up. He inherited that incredible skill of illegible handwriting from his own father. And it amazed him that not only could I read my husband's handwriting, I could read his father's as well, because we had a manuscript notes, handwritten notes from his dad, and I transcribed them onto the computer so they can be printed out for the family. I had lots of practice because I was a tutor for 25 years. And if you've ever worked with third or fourth grade boys writing cursive, if you can read it, then you're good. And my friend Borb says, can I read a doctor's handwriting? Yes, actually, I can. I am talented in that area. Not because my handwriting is indecipherable, it's not, but because I'm willing to put forth the effort to read it so that the kids continue to practice it and generally it improves. My friend Warp says the military could use me as a decoding specialist. Only if it's decoding somebody's handwriting. I'm not a code breaker. I don't think in that fashion. But anything, ladies and gentlemen, just about anything can be mastered if you put forth effort. There are some things that require a special talent or a gift. I could never be a concert violinist, for example. I do not have the talent, the skill, the ability to let the music flow through me and out through my fingers. I love music. I enjoy listening to it. I admire people who can play. I was substituting in band class today, not for the band teacher, but for the aide who usually is in there. And I can tell the difference between a good performance and a bad one, but I can't pick up the trumpet and demonstrate how you're supposed to play it. Yes, I can read music, but only the treble clef. So, you know, I come in handy. But all of the things that I have learned, ladies and gentlemen, have not come easily to me. Some of them have. And I am very grateful for what skills and gifts and talents I have. But I have always known, because I was taught, that I wasn't going to get everything in my head as easily as I did foreign languages and mathematics and reading. I had to work at science because it bored me silly. I cannot for the life of me do Sudoku for the same reason. I don't like numbers. They don't intrigue me. They don't interest me. I don't play with them. Words I love, and give me a crossword or an acrostic, anything like that, and I'm in seventh heaven. But I didn't refuse to do math because I didn't like it. And we have a student in our school right now who does exactly that and literally throws a tantrum and refuses to listen to help, because he has been allowed to demand that he be freed from math because he doesn't like it. Because, for whatever reason, somehow or other, he has some form of disability that he can use as an excuse to avoid something that is difficult for him. Not impossible, just difficult. Accommodations under the Americans with Disabilities Act for Education, ladies and gentlemen, were intended to help students for whom certain things were difficult. They were not intended to release that student from the responsibility of at least trying to learn them, unless the student's mental maturity level, used to be called IQ, was so low that the possibility of learning them didn't exist. Accommodations for people with physical disabilities do not demand that those people be required to do something they are physically incapable of. For example, you can't tell someone who is a quadriplegic that he has to get better and run a mile before he'll continue to receive his disability. But you can require that public buildings are wheelchair accessible. And that if this person has a helper animal or an aide, that that helper be allowed in public buildings with him. That's a reasonable accommodation. It's not a reasonable accommodation to tell a child that his disability allows him to avoid doing things that are hard for him. That's exactly the same thing as someone going through physical therapy after an injury or a stroke or some form of traumatic damage to rebuild muscles that have atrophied or have been damaged through the hard work of stretching and exercising them. We are using what had good intentions to tell children that they don't have to do anything that's hard. How does that prepare anybody for real living? Any single one of you out there who is over the age of 21 has experienced a hard time in your life. Every single one. And we have been prepared to deal with it because we have been brought up to believe, most of us, that there isn't an easy button for living. Those of us who are in our 60s, many of us who are in our 40s and 50s, grew up with an education system that taught us that we were responsible for the effort necessary to master an academic skill concept. We were responsible for our own success. It wasn't somebody else's fault that we failed our math test. It was ours because we didn't do our homework for 3 weeks and we didn't study. We would not have the situation we have now if we were realistic and understood that, yes, it's true. No two children learn in exactly the same way. But you cannot demand that a public school system supply individually tailored education to each and every child in its district. For one thing, it is prohibitively expensive. The number of staff that we have in each school per student has risen astronomically over the past 30 years. And we still cannot do what the federal government, under the ADA as it pertains to education, demands that we do as educators. The only way that you can do what they say we educators must do in order that everyone shall be equal is to have an individual tutor for every single child in the classroom. Are you willing, ladies and gentlemen, to impoverish yourself with taxes to provide this? I really doubt it. And neither is anybody else. But we are requiring our teachers to take the blame for not individually teaching each of our kids. For those of you who have children, you know that however many of them you have, no two of them are 100% identical in every way. They've got the same genetic inheritance if they have the same two parents, but they come out differently. Golly gee, what a horrible thought. They're not equal. Run and hide quickly. Somebody's going to come and arrest you. Child services is on the way. My friend Vorp says that our teachers are retards. Look at their union. Actually, I think that's kind of a blanket statement because many of them aren't and many of them don't want to be in the union. And in our state, they don't have to. But in unionized states like Michigan and a few others, you don't get to teach if you aren't in the union. your dues are deducted from your paycheck. And that's one of the reasons why the teachers in some states are better than teachers in others. And it isn't necessarily because they are poor teachers. It's because their union doesn't give a rat's backside about what they actually do. Their union cares only about power and money. Remember our two sayings? My friend Cal says some states could have non-union schools. Well, in effect, we do here in my state, in Virginia. Virginia is a right-to-work state. Nobody tells you you have to join the teachers' union. You can, even if you're not a certified teacher, like me. I could join the union, but I'll be, if I will. No, thank you. Many of the teachers do join the union. And they do because they want the union-backed lawyers and legal system to protect them from being blamed for everything by administration and parents. It doesn't really do a good job doing that, but it can, in certain ways, intimidate enough that teachers who are being blamed for things that are beyond their control can leave that particular school and go somewhere else without a black mark on their record that makes them unhirable. I don't like public facility unions, ladies and gentlemen, because by their very nature, they cannot be anything but corrupt. Public servants, those who work for government, state or federal, are using their quote-unquote right to unionize to inflate the pockets of the union bosses and basically threaten lawmakers to get what those unions want at the expense of everybody else in the state or country. Our public schools, ladies and gentlemen, have gone to the hot place in a handbasket because we have allowed ourselves to believe that teaching is somehow quantifiable on a data card, that teachers are endowed with superhuman powers, and that if they only did their job correctly, every child would get an A, or at least pass, no matter what they did outside school. And the teacher would remain calm and steadfast and loving and kind and generous and helpful every single day with every single class and never feel stressed, never, ever have to raise his or her voice. Because the magic of a teaching certificate makes them Superman or Superwoman. And nobody ever tells you about all the kryptonite in the basement of all of the schools. The teachers that I grew up with were dedicated professionals. They cared about turning the light on for students. Not all of them taught in the same way. They did not all have the same kinds of personalities. There were some that I genuinely liked as people, but were not really the best teacher. There were others who were fantastic teachers, and I didn't like them one bit. And there were some who had both qualities. They were likable people, and they were also excellent teachers. They were people, and that's the key word. Parents have a very different relationship with their children than teachers have with their students, and that is of necessity. Parents have a different role to play with children than teachers do. There is a belief out there that if you don't like your teacher, then you can't possibly learn anything from them. Like most progressive beliefs, this one is a falsehood. Granted, if you like your teacher, you're more inclined to listen when they talk, and it is likely, as a corollary, that you will learn more if you're listening. So in a sense, there is some truth to the idea that if you like your teacher, you'll learn more. But there is no truth to the idea, the extrapolation that progressives love to carry a common sense idea to absurdity, that if you don't like your teacher, it's impossible to learn anything from them. Fortunately, our children are being told that they are not responsible for anything when it comes to school. That all of the burden of knowledge going into their heads is on the teacher. Because if the knowledge doesn't go into their heads, merely by them entering the classroom and eventually sitting down, then the teacher is a bad teacher and they've been cheated. I don't know how many of you out there listening to me have ever been in a classroom in the current public school system as anything other than a visitor when it's Parents' Day or walking through to drop off something for your child who forgot his notebook at home or needed his gym shorts. I can highly recommend, ladies and gentlemen, that anybody who needs to know what's going on in our schools figure out a way to become a substitute. I'm not condemning you to it forever. Just give it a few months and take whatever calls come through. And in my state, you can be a substitute teacher if you have a high school diploma. You don't need a college education. Because you don't see what goes on in a classroom, ladies and gentlemen, when the principal is in there or when a parent is in there. Your children do not behave in the same way in their classrooms as you require them to behave at home if you think that they're quiet, well-behaved, and listening and willing to learn. They aren't. There are some who are, because they have been taught at home that education is an important thing for its own sake, not just for a grade on a report card, but because it's a valuable thing. It's a good. Knowing stuff is a good idea. They have parents who are constantly knowing stuff and learning new stuff. And then there are the ones who, for whatever reason, have somehow or other been told that an education is something that you have to get a good job, but you really don't have to put forth any effort to get it first because the schools owe you that so you can automatically have a good job when you're done with them. I read an article that was posted online several months ago. It came from a newspaper. I forget where the newspaper was. Forgive me if I can't ascribe the proper authorship to it. This article was a compilation of college student responses when they were asked, what would you say your high school teacher should have done better to get you prepared for college? And the vast majority of the college students said in very large numbers, number one, don't give us grades. Don't let us make up for poor work by doing extra credit cleaning the blackboard or bringing you an apple. Don't give us busy work as a makeup for knowing what you taught. Because here we are in college, and our professors won't do that. And that's why 60% of us flunk out before we complete a full year. My friend Vorp says discipline and reading skills. And yes, those are one and two. The idea that if you don't do the work, you get the grade you have earned. Common Core and standardized testing and the rest of the government-funded sticks to beat schools and teachers with are going to tell your children that it's common sense to say, I don't need to know that because it's not on the test. I've said before, program, that when I hear a student say that, if I were a redhead and had the temper to match, believe me, I would explode all over the classroom. I have come really, really close. My friend Bill says, let's wait till I get to Michelle and her lunches. That's probably going to come up next week. But anyway, when we teach to the test, ladies and gentlemen, we are telling our children that there are limits to what they need to know. We are telling them that ignorance is okay so long as you're not going to be tested on what you're ignorant about. Well, I have found in my life, ladies and gentlemen, that ignorance is never okay. And it isn't because I'm going to be tested. It's because I have lived a long life and have had to learn every single day of it. And some of the things I have had to learn have been painful and difficult and took a lot more effort than I wanted to expend. And not learning them cost me something of value. We are not teaching our children how to become functional adults, ladies and gentlemen. And it isn't so much because our teachers are all bad. They're not. They're no more all bad than every Marine is bad, or every doctor is bad, or every nurse is bad because you ran into a bad one in your life. It's because the system is bad. The people in it cannot change it from the inside because they do not have the power to do so. If they attempt to, they are no longer in the system. They are eliminated as unfit or troublemakers or unprofessional. When they demand work from their students, all of their students, if they do not bow to the prevailing wind that says you can't make them do it if they think it's too hard, they keep their job. If they don't bow to that wind and refuse to accommodate, they are unprofessional. They are creating a legal basis for parents to sue the school, and they are removed from employment. My friend Cal says, kids don't want to be educated in the proper way. They want now, instant. And that's quite true. So does everybody else, because we get instant. That's one of those other factors I was talking about that have contributed to the slump in the quality of our education. We live in a world that almost guarantees us instant gratification. About the only people who don't get instant gratification anymore, farmers, because they still have to wait for the seed to grow. But everybody else, I want it now. Our kids, when they're bored, they push a button, and they get whatever entertainment that button connects to. They want to talk to somebody. They don't go next door and actually physically move off the couch. They pull out their phone and text them. This easy button mentality, ladies and gentlemen, this instant gratification habit that we have, one of the factors that has brought the expectation level down. Parents don't want to deprive their children of the latest in technological advances. They don't want their child to feel ostracized because he doesn't have the latest iPhone 5 or the most expensive $300 sneakers advertised by a basketball player. They don't want their child to feel bullied because he or she hasn't got what everybody else has. Well, I remember when I was in fourth and fifth grade, when my saber tooth and I used to go to school together, I never had the cartoon character or television character notebooks, you know, the loose leaf binders that the other kids had. My father refused to pay twice as much for a binder that had the picture of some actor or some cartoon character on it when it was supposed to be storing papers and not be an advertisement for somebody's television show. And I moaned and cried and everything else, and, oh, but everybody else has them, Daddy. And he said, well, sorry, you won't. And that was the end of it. So I carried a plain blue or a plain black binder to school all the way through. And guess what? I survived. Yeah. With my self-esteem intact. Because the esteem, my self-esteem wasn't based on whether or not all the other kids thought I had a cool binder. My self-esteem was based on the fact that I got freaking straight A's. And the papers in my binder all had A's on them. It may not have looked beautiful on the outside or cool or neat, but inside showed that I had learned things. And it's that I want what everybody else has, otherwise my self-esteem and my character will be warped forever and I will be unsuccessful as a complete human being because I was bullied when I was 9 because my shoes weren't $300 specialty sneakers. And you know what, ladies and gentlemen? I'm glad that my father didn't give me everything I wanted. Because I grew up understanding that life and living it has priorities. And those priorities were not always what I wanted. So I was better prepared to meet the times that I've lived through. The losses, the difficulties, the tough times, the hard times. I was prepared for them because nobody told me that I was owed anything. Nobody promised me the moon and patted me on the back and consoled me when they couldn't get it for me. Nobody told me that my grades were given to me because the teacher liked me. Nobody told me that if it was hard, I didn't have to do it. Nobody told me that I was so special that I didn't have to put forth any effort to do things. I got praise when I earned it and criticism when it was necessary. And I don't like criticism, ladies and gentlemen. Nobody I know does. I dislike it intensely to this day. But it doesn't mean if somebody criticizes me, I'm going to go pick up a pistol and shoot them or go hide in a corner and beat myself against a wall because somebody was mean to me and didn't like me and everybody's supposed to love me. Otherwise, I don't feel bad. And believe me, I have had kids react like that brief demonstration because they did something incorrectly on a paper and it was explained to them how to fix it. My friend Gal says she hates it. When they call things constructive criticism. Yeah, me too. Because basically when you're being criticized, that means somebody thinks that you've done something wrong. They're not building anything. They're tearing it down. So it's the opposite of constructive. But every one of us has to face it sooner or later because I don't know anybody who's perfect, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know anyone who has never, ever made a mistake or done something that wasn't correct or maybe did something that was inappropriate for the time and place or made a bad decision or a wrong choice. We do. It's the nature of human beings. We are not perfect creatures. And no educational system in the world can make us perfect. No educational system, no government, no progressive think tank can compensate us for whatever it is we're born with or born without. I cannot learn for your children, ladies and gentlemen, and neither can anyone else in the education business. We simply cannot do it. We can creatively think of 40,000 different ways to present information in hopes that one of them will strike a chord with the majority of the kids we teach. We can't guarantee that your child will get an A in whatever we teach. There's no way we can. Any more than you could guarantee somebody else that you could magically make them, 7 inches taller than they are because it would make them feel good. I can't put a brain in the head of someone who doesn't have one. I cannot give your child knowledge if he or she doesn't put forth a hand to take it. I can't open their skulls and put what I have learned in 67 years of living into their minds with no effort on their part. If I could, I would probably be worshipped as a goddess. And believe me, I don't particularly want to be a goddess. Or at least I'd be probably the richest woman in the entire known universe. Or I'd be arrested and put in a laboratory while they took my brain apart to figure out how to do it. So everybody could, and I don't like that idea either. What I can do, ladies and gentlemen, is to give of what I have learned to your child. I can give your child the information that I have gained. I can help them see what they are learning in maybe a slightly different way so that it comes to life for them. I can help them over a rough patch if they just can't see the relationship between multiplication and division. I'll sit beside them with a handful of pennies and show them that 16 pennies divided into groups of four, you get four groups. So four fours make 16. So if I want to say how many groups of four, I can pull apart and I can say, guess what? Four groups. And I have taught people how to divide that way. Because it was the concept they didn't get. Once they understood that, after maybe 7 hours of tutoring, they didn't need the pennies anymore. but it helped them internalize the concept. And I was thrilled. I was absolutely ecstatic because I'd helped somebody learn something that was hard for them, because I told them they didn't have to. But because I helped them with something that was hard, and they put forth the effort to try to grasp it, and they did. This is what we need to allow our teachers to do, ladies and gentlemen. We do not need to blame them because they are not magic. We do not need to tar them with the union brush. In states where union membership is demanded if you wish to work. We cannot allow our children to be taught to become victims. I won't allow my students, whether I'm substituting in a regular classroom or dealing with the miscreants who are sentenced to my mini jail for inappropriate behavior, I will not allow them to give me excuses for not trying. I will not permit them to refuse to try to do something because this is too hard, cry. I will not let them get by with the idea that when they don't put forth effort, it's always somebody else's fault. And strangely enough, ladies and gentlemen, the rules in my classroom are exactly the same rules that existed in every classroom when my saber tooth and I were in school. And my rules are now considered to be punishment. Not being permitted to talk out whenever you feel like it, having to raise your hand and wait to be called upon before you speak, not being allowed to get up and wander around the room, you must remain in your seat unless you ask permission to get up, limited restroom visits to 2 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon after lunch, work all the time you're there, courteous behavior, diligent effort, and adherence to the policies of my classroom. This is jail in our modern schools, ladies and gentlemen. This is punishment. But strangely enough, and this is from my friend Cal, roughly 80% of the students that I have in ISS tell me they wish they could spend the whole day there more often. I had one young lady that was in my ISS room on yesterday, who, as the children were leaving to get on the buses, stopped and said, "Mrs. Rowland, is there any way I can get in here without getting in trouble?" I said, "Well, I'm afraid not." She said, "Boy, I wish there was." And it's both gratifying and saddening, ladies and gentlemen. It's gratifying because I've made a positive effect on that child. And hopefully something that I've taught or said to her, she'll carry on and do something good with. But saddening in that, why does she not feel that way about her regular classes? Why are they so impossible to learn in? These are not the schools, ladies and gentlemen, that I remember. and they are not the schools that I want my grandchildren to grow up in. And I'm pretty sure they aren't the schools that you want your children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews and cousins and all of your young relatives to grow up in. And it takes you. I have substituted in regular classes, ladies and gentlemen, and I have spent 40 minutes out of a 60-minute classroom hour trying to get people to close their mouths long enough to listen to instruction or directions. This needs to stop. This needs to stop as soon as possible. I'm asking all of you, please get involved with your local parent-teacher organization. Go to your school board open meetings. Talk to your school board members. Get to meet your superintendent of schools. Talk to the principals. Find out what they're teaching and how they're teaching. Get on the ranks of the substitute teachers so you can see for yourself what it's like. Get to know some of the people who are trying to teach and who are being bound and gagged every moment of their classroom time. Because until everybody starts really taking a real interest, not just a let's blame somebody, you aren't going to be able to fix it. You are the nation, ladies and gentlemen. And if the nation needs fixing, you're the ones who have to do it. We all are. Thank you so much, everybody, for being here tonight. Thanks to all my friends in the chat room, Cal and Rod, who left a little early, Yo, who was having trouble getting in, Phil and Linda, of course, and Vorp. All of you, thank you so much for the support and for being here tonight and for listening to me. I hope that it's been entertaining and enlightening.
60 seconds.
And I hope you'll join me next week for Patriot Education here on Blog Talk Radio. And you'll visit us on our website, www.patriotfamilies.com. As always, bless you all and all my love to my greatest fan. Good night, everyone, and thank you again for being here tonight. Take care.